Thanks, Ms. Lanning.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Bacon. Good evening, Amar Rabosa, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. First of all, on the one hand, I would say that it's a great personal privilege and pleasure to be able to participate in a presentation this evening together with Dr. David Pelkovitz, who's a noted speaker and a noted psychologist in our community. He's done so much for so many people himself in our community, and I've had the honor of participating together with Dr. Pelkovitz in other presentations and other forums as well on a number of occasions, and he always has so many things that are interesting and informative and enlightening to say. I'm sure it'll be no different this evening. But on the other hand, we're here with a certain amount of sadness, because what we're doing this evening is we're paying tribute to somebody certainly who is well-deserving of whatever words of tribute we will share, and then some, but it's somebody who unfortunately is no longer with us. It's a memorial tribute. And we know that Rabbi Dr. Abraham J. Twersky, Zichron Levracha, Harav Avraham Yeshua Heschel, and Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael, Twersky was taken from us a number of weeks ago after a long and fruitful career in which he impacted and helped and influenced literally, really thousands of people. And I think it's our task this evening to try and share some zichronos, to share some personal memories, not only in tribute to him, but I think what he would want is that through those stories and ideas that we share, that people will become uplifted themselves and will be inspired to change, to improve. And if we're able to do that, then Bezer Hashem will be very successful. I'm here because I had a personal relationship with Rabbi Twersky, Zichron Levracha, that spanned really many, many years from three very, very different venues. The first time I ever met Rabbi Twersky was in a town called McKeesport, Pennsylvania. Now, McKeesport, Pennsylvania is a suburb of Pittsburgh, and my uncle, I had an uncle who was the Rav there for many, many decades. He's not in this world anymore either, Zichron Levracha, wonderful person. And he was the Rav in McKeesport, as I said, a suburb of Pittsburgh. And as many of you know, Rabbi Twersky spent the majority of his adult years and professional years living in Pittsburgh in the Jewish community there. And so my uncle and Rabbi Twersky developed a very long and warm and very, very close relationship. They learned together, and they were involved in Sibur work together and so on. And it's through my uncle that I met Rabbi Twersky. And I think the first time I was 7 or 8 years old, my cousin, maybe 5 years older than me or so, my cousin was having his bar mitzvah in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, my uncle's son. And my family came from Teaneck. We traveled to McKeesport to the bar mitzvah. And the Twersky family, again, being very close to my uncle and his family, they also came to McKeesport. I said McKeesport's a suburb of Pittsburgh, not walking distance. So they came to McKeesport as well. And all the families that were participating in the Simcha, we ate the Friday night and Shabbos in the social hall of the shul. And I saw this individual, this person, I didn't know who he was, but he looked different than everybody else. And, you know, he had the regular Hasidic levush, which I wasn't accustomed to seeing. I think maybe I'd seen it before, but never up close. I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey. And suffice to say that when I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey, Teaneck looked nothing like it looks today. I'll just say one simple ha'ara. There were no kosher food establishments in Teaneck when I grew up. Okay, and it was one shul. Enough said. So I really had never seen someone who looked like a Twersky up close, but I was taken by this man's appearance. He had a long kapot and a big strimal and a beard, but he had a certain twinkle in his eye and a smile. And I was just looking at him, you know, during the course of this Friday evening. I still remember he made hamotzi over this big challah. I guess his wife must have baked it. He had other challahs around. That's the meaning of some Hasidim, to make hamotzi on multiple challahs and so on, not just on lechemisha. I don't know that he followed that practice all the time, but that's what I remember from then, this big challah and lots of other little challahs around. And I say he had a regal kind of royal appearance to him and a smile. And I was just, you know, I wanted to see. I just looked at him. I guess I'm a little kid, and you know, I guess I was staring, you know, too much. And he came over and he shook my hand and he said, "What's your name?" And I told him my name and I ran back to my table, you know, to my mother. And my mother, Shalom, said, my father and mother said, "You know, Michael, that man is a doctor." I said, "A doctor?" Like, I, you know, I was used to a doctor, had a long white coat, not a long black coat. And he had a stethoscope around his head, not a strum around his head. But okay, he was a doctor. And that just, you know, I didn't even know what to make of it because it was so different, so unique. And then a little later, I forgot whether it was Friday night or Shabbos lunch, he was entertaining the crowd. He sang Gramin. Now, I have to say, I didn't understand the Gramen because they were in Yiddish, and I didn't speak too much Yiddish in those days. But here was this man who looked different, and he was a doctor, and he's entertaining the crowd. There was obviously something unique about this individual. And so that was my first exposure to him, and other occasions, other simchas, my mother, Shem Sal, my uncle, in McKeesport, Pennsylvania. And that really is what my impression is of Rabbi Twersky, just a singular, unique individual, so many different steers, so to speak, and this one person, which he brought together very so beautifully. Of course, I found out later he was not just any chassid, and he was not just any doctor. Okay, he was a chassid coming from the most distinguished of chassidish yichas, from the dynasty of Chernobyl. Those who are familiar, Tolan and Rachmistrivk and Skver, and of course the ankle of the Hornsteipel dynasty, and from his mother's side related to the Baba Rebbe, the Halberstam family. I mean, you know, the elite chassidish yichas. And obviously it was something he was very proud of. He told me on more than one occasion that he used to stay with the old Baba Rebbe, who refounded the Baba after the war. We founded the Baba community here in Brooklyn today. That brother, Shlomo Halberstam Zichrono Livracha, that Rebbe, he was close with him and he stayed in his house and so on. And he had a very, very terrific pride in his Hasidic stock. And certainly anyone who's read any of his writings, he wrote so much about Hasidus, and he used the teachings of Hasidus to impact his self-help books and his other things that were designed to help people. He drew from that rich Hasidic tradition. So he was certainly not just any Hasid. But he was also not just any doctor. He grew up in Milwaukee. His father, Yaakov Yisrael Twersky, Zichrono Livracha, was at a shul, a rebbe in Milwaukee. In the 1930s, when he grew up, there were no yeshivas in Milwaukee, so Rabbi Twersky went to public school as a young man. He was very bright. He skipped a couple of grades, but he was a student in public school. And actually, there's a story which he related on more than one occasion. Perhaps some of you have read it in recently. He was growing up in a public school in Milwaukee, so he participated in the school's Christmas pageant. Okay, in the end of December, and he had a role in the school's Christmas show, and shortly thereafter, his mother, the Rebbetzin Twersky, called up the teacher, and the teacher assumed that this Jewish woman, this rabbi's wife, was calling to voice a complaint about the fact that he had to participate in a Christmas pageant and so on, and that's not what Mrs. Twersky was calling about. Apparently, Rabbi Twersky, as a young boy, was short. They called him Abe. And the mother called, did my son Abe feel self-conscious about the fact that he was shorter than the other students in the play? And the teacher said, no, he seemed to comport himself very well. But the teacher said, I thought you were going to call me to object to the fact that he was in the Christmas play and this might challenge him in terms of his beliefs he's getting home. I know this is not your tradition. And the Rebbetzin Twersky responded, if being in a Christmas play is going to challenge what we're teaching him at home, then we're not teaching him well at home. We're not doing a good enough job at home. And I thought that was a very insightful remark by his mother and helped explain who he is and how he was able to master being in different worlds at the same time, which is part of his singularity. He attended Marquette University, which is a Roman Catholic university in Milwaukee. As some people now have heard the story, part of his tuition for a number of years was paid by a famous Hollywood personality by the name of Danny Thomas. Now, Danny Thomas was a leading comedian a little bit before my time. I'm not quite that old, a little before my time. His daughter was an actress. That was already my time. But Danny Thomas was a famous Hollywood personality, famous comedian in the 1950s. I heard the story that he met him on a train, but recently they published a story that wasn't on a train, that somehow this Danny Thomas heard about a young man who was studying in university who couldn't afford the tuition. And as Danny Thomas, this is known, he was a very philanthropic and generous person, a Lebanese Christian, not a Jew. Hollywood comedians was not Jewish, but he nevertheless agreed to pay for the tuition for this young man. And there are pictures now that surfaced of him, of Twersky and Danny Thomas. And He later on wanted to pay him back. When he made it on his own, he wanted to pay back this Danny Thomas for having funded his tuition. And Danny Thomas, of course, refused to accept it. But Danny Thomas himself started a children's hospital that still exists today. So Twersky took all the money that Danny Thomas had laid out and donated it to Danny Thomas's children's hospital. So that was his relationship with Danny Thomas. He said personally that he was interested in going into psychiatry because of his desire to help people. He saw that the older people, the European transplants and so on, who were living in Milwaukee, would come to his father, Siddush Rebbe, with all kinds of issues and problems they had and so on. But he felt that the younger generation was turning now more to professionals, to the kind of advice that people previously perhaps got from their Rebbe, and he felt he was going to be successful, he was going to be able to help people. He had to have, a background in psychiatry and official, professional training. And so that's when I found out, and again, as I learned more and more about him, not only wasn't any old chassid, he also wasn't any old doctor. He became a leading psychiatrist in the country. He founded in Pittsburgh, together with nuns, a rehabilitation center. The Gateway Rehabilitation Center is considered, and Dr. Pelkowitz can probably talk more about it, it's considered, I think, to this day, one of the most outstanding rehabilitation centers in the United States. Just helped hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of people. If you go on now, and I did myself, if you go on the Gateway Rehabilitation site, they put up memorial, a thing in memory of Rabbi Twersky, the founder, and they invited people who had gone through that program to contribute the words, a few words of commemoration and of thanks. And you can read, it's pages and pages. I didn't read all of it, but people from all walks of life, not talking about Jews now, talking about some Jews too, but lots of other people talking about how Rabbi T, they called him Rabbi T. Rabbi T saved my life. If not for Rabbi T, I never would have become sober. If not for Rabbi T, I never would have gotten off drugs. If not for Rabbi T, I would never have been able to maintain my marriage, my family. V'chahena, v'chahena. I urge anyone who want to be inspired, go on Gateway Rehabilitation Center of Pittsburgh, and you scan through there. You can find things that people posted in the last couple of weeks. Just remarkable, the number of people that he helped. I remember one amusing story that we heard in the family. I think it was my uncle that told it to me, and it was corroborated that it was true. There was a certain individual who was in that hospital who apparently had messianic tendencies or messianic beliefs. He thought he was the Messiah, that he was going to introduce the Messiah, something like that. And so he wasn't well, and he was being treated apparently by a different doctor. And it was concluded at some point that this man was ready to be released. Rabbi Twersky, as the head of the hospital, had to sign him out. And it was a Motzei Shabbos in the wintertime. So Shabbos over relatively early. So Rabbi Twersky came to the hospital, and he was still wearing his big day Shabbos. He still had the kapot and the shtreimel and so on and so forth. And he was coming into the room to meet with this individual to finally ascertain whether he indeed is ready to leave the hospital just yet. And when he walked into the room, the man saw him and he said, "The Lord has risen," bowed down. He starts kissing his feet, And Rabbi Twersky realized perhaps he's not quite ready yet to leave the hospital. But again, he impacted so many people. There's a famous story which relates to halacha that, when you work with recovering alcoholics, so they're not allowed to drink at all. Now, they can't even drink anything ever again. And one of the people he was working with was a Catholic priest. And the priest said, "But I can't not drink because my religious requirements, sometimes sacraments and whatever else, require that I drink wine." But the recovery program is such, you can't drink wine. But he told him that, by us, by the Jews, according to many authorities, in most cases, when wine is required, grape juice suffices. So this Catholic priest sent the Shaila up the line to different authorities and Catholic practices and so on and so forth. And originally was told, no, it has to be wine and so on. Okay, we have L'Havdil, discussions in Boskin about that also with the Arbakosis and other things. But anyway, eventually Rabbi Twersky wrote a letter that I think made it maybe to the Vatican or certainly to some higher ups, indicating with Jewish sources of why, according to many authorities, grape juice suffices. And the conclusion was that if that's okay, with the Jews, they consider that acceptable for wine. We can do it also for those same reasons. And therefore, this person was able to recover by drinking grape juice instead. So again, a fascinating person drawing from so many different areas, bringing it to help people of all walks and people from all backgrounds. My second interaction with him came, again, other than having heard him speak sometimes and read books, he wrote so many books. He wrote, I don't know, 60 books, 80 books, all kinds of different numbers that are out. I'm not sure everyone has a count. My uncle, the Rav, from Mekisport, used to tell him, again, they were friends, used to kibitz. He says, he used to call him Shia. His name is Avram Yoshua Heschel. He called him Shia. His friends called him Shia. He said, Rav Shia, I think you have diarrhea of the pen. That's what he's going to make his work, because he churned out books like nothing, books after books after books. So I had some of the books and read some of the books, both on Jewish topics and other topics. Some people know that he collaborated with the author, the cartoonist Charles Schulz from Peanuts and Charlie Brown. Anyway, so my next personal connection came in the 1990s. Rabbi Twersky was then in his 60s, and he decided to semi-retire. Part-time retire. And so he purchased a home in Eretz Yisrael where he would spend, he'd want to spend about half the year exactly, but several months a year, certainly from Tovim and so on. And of all places to pick to live, he picked to live in Efrat. And again, a Chassidish person, Efrat is not exactly brimming with Chassidim. okay, in a nice, beautiful Dati Lumi community, but it's not many Hasidim there. But that's not Rabbi Tversky. He didn't care about that kind of stuff. He didn't, you know, he was who he was, and he accepted other people who they were. And lo and behold, he bought a house right next door to my sister. My sister's lived in Efrat for many years, still lives there. And he lived next door to my sister. And then I got to see through my sister just who this man was. First of all, the humility of the person. Such a humble person. You call on the phone. My sister's name is Judy. Hello, Judy. Tversky here. Okay, and my brother-in-law is Baruch. Hi, Baruch. This is Tversky. That's how you talk. No fancy pretense. This is Tversky. Okay, and I know that from later on in Argentina. We'll get to that. But that's how he called up. Judy, this is Tversky. Can I borrow a cup of sugar? That's just the way he talked. Just so down to earth, so ordinary. And my sister, when he wasn't there, looked after the house. In fact, I personally slept in his house on a number of occasions when I go to Eretz Yisrael when he wasn't there. Sometimes that's when he was there, but when he wasn't, I was asleep in his house. And that was my other connection. By then, and he was also, Rabbi Tversky was a Sandik, one of my nephews, Brisson, and so on, because he had developed this relationship with my sister, my brother-in-law. Through my brother-in-law, Baruch Sturman, is one of the people who manufactures and is involved in the trelis, the modern-day trelis. You know, the many people wear the trelis. Now Yeshiva Rosh Hashanah and others wear the trelis. Rabbi Tversky also wore that trelis. And it's interesting because he said, my brother-in-law told me that he said this to him. You know, my brother was surprised because after all, he's coming from a Hasidic background, and the Hasidim are usually very, very careful about minhag, beis av, and so on, the minhag avosenu. And he asked him, your father certainly never wore tchelis. And he said, you know, that it's not my job necessarily to do everything my father did. It's to do what I think my father would do if he had the same information, the same circumstance that I'm in. Which is a very interesting answer. And later on, actually in my shul, he spoke about one of the dangers of our generation is in terms of, in terms of Shmiras Einayim and issues that we see and things that we can look at and do look at and so on. And he got involved in Shmiras Einayim projects towards the end of his life. He felt the Tcheles, which is something, Urisam Oso, Uzchartim, Skomitzah Hashem, was a very precious mitzvah. And he had the opportunity to do a mitzvah d'oraisa, according to many authorities, and therefore he would wear that Tcheles. But I got to see there, also in conversations and just finding out in general, that aside from being a very unique chassid and a very unique doctor, he was also, and I want to say this, carefully, he was a Talmud Chacham of the first order. And a lot of people don't know that. Okay, he was very close to the Stipler. Okay, his Zeder, Motto Hornstipler, he told me, gave a bracha. He told me that the Stipler's parents, the Stipler, the great Rabbi Chaim, those who today, tell me them today, Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky, the Shalita, so Sarah Torah, they refer to him, right? So Chaim Kanievsky's father was the great Stipler, Gon Kilis Yaakov, on all the Masechtas and Shas and so on, others for him. So the Stipler, the parents of the Stipler originally had trouble having children, and they went to Rabbi Tversky Zeder, Motov Honestipel, for a bracha, and they gave him a bracha, and the Stipler was born. So they named him Yaakov Yisrael, which is Rabbi Tversky's own father. That's a Tversky name. That's a Chernobyl name. So anyway, they named him Yaakov Yisrael. So Rabbi Tversky had a lifelong relationship with the Stipler, who he turned to for Hadrocha in many, many areas. In any event, in fact, there's a letter printed, the safe that I'm about to show you, when he wanted to go to medical school, he asked the Stipler, whether it's okay to go to medical school, non-Jewish medical school, and so on. And the Stipler mentioned a few things. He said, you can go, but you have to have siddurim for learning every single day, and you should try to get to the mikveh every day, make sure you daven a minyan every day, you have to learn musar every day. He gave him all kinds of rules, and no secular studies on Shabbos. And he also told him, and you have to mispalel for siyata d'shmaya. In any event, I came across a sefer a bunch of years ago, at this time in a swarm store in Eretz Yisrael somewhere. It's called Ye'omer LeYaakov UleYisrael. Ye'omer LeYaakov, that's a pasuk in Parshas Balak. Ye'omer LeYaakov UleYisrael. It's Michtav Torah LeRabbeinu Kilos Yaakov. If you look in this sefer, this is an exchange of letters between Rabbi Tversky, Rabbi Shia Tversky, Rabbi Abraham J. Tversky, and the Stipler Gaon. And for the yeshiva boys here, let me tell you, these are yeshiva topics. Okay, b'chol mikzos haTorah, letters back and forth with the Stipler. I'm just reading, random sampling. Okay, hasra sofik. Okay, binyan mekalkel on Shabbos. Mashkin metamin. I'm just reading random things. Yeshlich dvar aver b'meila. Yeshivas are topics on kodshim and on taris and on zroim truma and about mikvos and all kinds of different subjects. Yeshivas sugyas, shas sugyas, and here is communicating with the Stipler, one of the gedolei hador mamish. Now, I didn't have the schus to know the Stipler, but from what I do know about the Stipler, I don't think he was prone to free or frivolous compliments. It wasn't that type of person. But in the introduction to this sefer, Rabbi Tversky presents a letter that the Stipler wrote to him, and sign of Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, that's the Stipler, and he writes, Be'emes ani mispalel I know you've been involved in the medical world and your parnosa for many years. I know you're kovetim latorah, but still, here's what the stipler writes. V'hinehu mefalpel tila Hashem yisbarach barachovo v'sugyos amukos ketamr chocham halomeid b'kolel kol hayom. I take that compliment from anybody, okay? What the stipler says is, for those who understand, I'll explain. The stipler, despite the fact that you're involved in medicine and so many other activities, you write divrei Torah like somebody who sits and learns in a kollel all day long. It's a pretty heavy-duty compliment from the stipler. And again, he was, on top of everything else, a Talmud Chochem of the first order. So humble and so unassuming. And again, that he had this rich Hasidic tradition and Hasidic background. Okay, that's wonderful. He knows probably every Hasidic story there was. He wrote many books. I mean, there's a book here called Not Just Stories. Maybe I'm getting towards the Hasidic spirit through its classic stories. Another book, Rebbe's and Hasidim, what they said, what they meant. Many books on Hasidic, Maiselach and so on, Hasidic stories, inspiring. But besides that, he was a Talmud Chochem of the first order. And no other aid beside the stipend is necessary to confirm that. The third venue in which I had the connection to Rabbi Twersky, and Rabbi Bacon mentioned it before, towards the end of his, after he retired and so on and so forth, so he ended up moving to Teaneck. And lo and behold, he bought a house around the corner from my shul. And so it was the closest shul to him, and that's where he started to daven, and he immediately became a favorite of the people in the shul, obviously treated him with great covet. Everybody, I mean, by now, everyone knew who he was and what he accomplished and his tremendous personality, and he helped many people in the community, not only in my shul, but in others as well, and people would call me because they knew I somehow became almost like a secretary because people would call me, I understand Robert Twersky davening shul, I need to speak to him about this, can you set this up, and so on and so forth, and I hesitated to do it. But he told me, don't hesitate. If I can't do it, I'll tell you no. So I would call him, and most of the time the answer was yes. He's happy to see this person, happy to meet with this person, happy to help this person. That was his nature. It's just a tremendous asset, certainly, to our shul. When I went away for Shabbos, so I had an easy time deciding who to ask to speak, because Rabbi Twersky. I just didn't want to do it too often because I didn't want the people to say, Rabbi Talbis, why don't you go away more often? You know, I would like to hear Rabbi Twersky. So I couldn't do it too often. But the truth is, he displayed, and I think it was not so much for me, maybe a little bit for me, but also to teach the people. He had tremendous covet for me as the Rav of the shul. In those years, his hearing was already going. He had difficulty hearing. He had a hearing aid. He had trouble hearing. And so he had a certain seat in the shul by an aisle, okay, which was a seat. He had a shtender there and so on and so forth. But when I spoke, whenever I gave a Dvar Torah or Shir or anything else, he walked to the front of the shul, sat in the front row, so he'd be able to hear what I had to say. I think it was not only to cover it for me, but also to show people in the shul. He was a man of great stature and great learning, much greater than I and so on. But I was the rabbi of the shul, and he felt it was important for him and for people to know there's a certain thing called kavod harav, and therefore he always came to the front of the shul and sat down there when I spoke. And I was always very, very touched by that. I can tell you, those years he went, he no longer had the place in Efrat. That was with his first wife. His first wife passed away, and he was now with his second wife. So he had the place somewhere else in Eretz Yisrael, in Katamon. And he would leave for Eretz Yisrael, go for the Yom Tov, and he'd leave for Pesach, he would leave before Purim. So I was kibitzing because he was definitely the only person in my shul who would sell me his chometz before Purim. He came before Purim because he was leaving for Eretz Yisrael, and he would sell me his chometz before Purim. But again, wonderful zichronos within the shul. So as I said at the outset, and I will just conclude with a few divrei Torah of his, I think I should leave you with. But just before that, a singular, unique individual at home in so many different areas, no pretenses about who he was and his tremendous accomplishments and his ability to help people on so many different levels and so many different venues. The books that he wrote, and this I've seen in my own eyes. You know, you go to a Sfarim store sometimes, so they have different rows of Sfarim. So there's a big sign. This is Chumash and Mefarshim. This is Shas. This is Rishonim, Achronim, Shalos HaTshuvas, Musar, Hashkofa, Twersky. There'd be a whole section, Twersky. It became its own genre because he wrote so many different books. You know, and again, I've seen that. I saw that in more than one Sfarim store on more than one occasion. There's in the introduction to this book, Rebbe's in Chassidim, Rabbi Twersky wrote the following, and I share it because I think it's, I think it typifies who he was. Okay. He said that, Chassidus teaches that one must always judge others favorably. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Berditchev is particularly noted for his defense of the Jewish people. One time he noticed a porter greasing the axle of the wagon while wearing his talis and tefillin. Where others would have seen this as gross disrespect for the Talis and Tefillin, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak said, Master of the universe, just look at how your children are devoted to you. Even when he greases the axle of the wagon, the porter wears his Talis and Tefillin to be in constant contact with you. Chassidus finds this in the words of Bilam. He perceived no iniquity in Jacob, saw no perversity in Israel. Hashem, his God, is with him. Said Rabbi Levi Yitzchak, if one sees no faults among Israel, then God is surely with him. The wisdom of Chassidus, as transmitted by both Rebbes and Chassidim, is a rich repository of Torah teachings, which contain valuable guidelines for daily life. And the contents of this book are but a fragment of Chassidic teaching that can illuminate a path in life. That, I think, you could write that about him, because that's exactly the attitude that he took. And as I said, just the two Divrei Torah, one which I heard him say, I don't know if it's written up, and the other one which has been written up. And with this, we'll conclude and turn the floor over to Dr. Pelkowitz. I'm sure we'll have a lot of fascinating insights as well. There's a pasuk, and by the way, I want to suggest, because the time is late, but I want to suggest when he was getting older and he was getting more frail in Eretz Yisrael, he wrote a beautiful article called My Well Has Run Dry. I recommend everybody read it. Okay, maybe Dr. Pelk will talk more about it, but he speaks about, I don't know if he will, but take a look. He speaks about the idea of recognizing, and you get old, and that's how he's forgetting where to find this forum, and when he finds this forum, where to find the reference he's looking for. He can't speak the way he used to, and he can't, think the way he used to, but he nevertheless sees his mission to serve our Kaddish Baruch as best he can now. And I read it out loud if I had the time. I'm not going to read it. Look for it. You can get it. The Well Has Run Dry. That's what's called. It appeared in 2018 in the Mishpacha, but I'm sure you can get it online. But the Dvar Torah that I want to share with you, two quick Dvar Torah. One, the Pasuk says in Parshas Vayetze that when Yaakov Avinu wanted to marry Rachel, so Lavan said, first you have to work for 7 years. Okay, and this bothered me also when I heard it. It's a difficult pasuk to explain in terms of the simple pshat. It said, so he worked for 7 years, and he said the 7 years seemed kiyamim achadim b'avosa osa. It just seemed like a couple of days. He loved her so much, and the 7 years went by just like a couple of days because he loved Rachel so much. So I always thought it was a problem, because what do you mean? If you want something so badly, so fakir, it's really opposite. 7 years should seem like 700 years. Imagine, I explained to the high school students, imagine you can't wait to get out of the class. So you look at your watch. What? Only 1 minute went by since I last looked at my watch. Seems like an hour already, right? When you want something badly, time seems to go by so slowly. And here the Pasuk says the exact opposite. The Pasuk said the years went by just like a few days because he loved it so much. It's counterintuitive. So Retorsky explained, I don't know if it's written up. It probably is written up someplace, but he told this to me once. He said, when you have a recovering alcoholic or recovering drug addict, so you tell the person you can never, like we spoke about before, you can never have another glass of wine. You can never have another joint or whatever it is. You can never take this drug again. You tell the person that, the person will say, forget it, I can't do it. Never, ever again, impossible. I can't do it. Never have another drink again, ever. Not going to do it. And the person will give up immediately. That's what you do in training the person. You tell the person to look at each day by itself. Can I do without the glass of wine today? Can I make it through today? Forget about it. Can I make it through today without this, without this addictive product? Oh yeah, I can. One day I can do. And the next day, can you make it through today without it? Can you make it? That's how you have to look at it. That's how they work with the recovering addicts. But can I make it through each day, one day at a time? One day at a time. So Retorsky said, maybe that's the pshat in the pasuk, right? Ki yamim achadim. He loved Rachel so much. Can I make it one day without her? Oh, one more day I can make without her. Then the next day, can I make another day without? Oh, another day I can make without her, and so on. That's what it means. Kiyamim achadim. I thought it was a very interesting pshat. Again, bringing to bear his background with the recovering addicts. And finally, just in connection with the sedras that we're reading now, we just read yesterday about Mamad Har Sinai and Nasa and Nishma and Parashat Mishpatim. So we know the Medrash says that the Kadosh Baruch Hu initially offered the Torah to all the other nations. Hashem Misinai Bo, Pasuk says in Mezos HaBaracha, Hashem Misinai Bo, and so on. And Bezerach Miseir Lamo. So the Medrash says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu initially offered the Torah to the Umos Olam, to other nations, to other peoples of the world. And he said, they asked him, so what's in it? So he told this group, oh, it says Lo Sirtzo. They said, don't murder, that's not for us. We can't live it like that. And then the other group asked, what's in the Torah? He said, you're not allowed to steal. Oh, you're not allowed to steal. That we can't do. Okay, and so Chahena V'Chahena until Klal Yisrael said Nasa V'Nishma. So the question is, at first it would appear that this is a bit of a disingenuous offer. Was HaKadosh Baruch Hu really offering the Torah? He set them up to fail. right? Because when they asked what's in the Torah, he told them the one thing that was against their culture and against their civilization. So he set them up not to accept it. Why didn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell them first a bunch of attractive mitzvahs, things that are exciting, wonderful, and then, oh, by the way, there's also some other, you know, set it up, they would want to accept it. So it's an interesting question. Ratorsky said, because the essence of Kabbalah Satorah is accepting your ability to change. That's what it's all about. That a person does not stand still. A person is not stationary. A person can always improve. That's what tshuva is all about. That we can talk about this, you know, in many, many different areas. But the essence of Kabbalah Satorah is that I can change who I am for the better, and I can change who I am because Hashem said so. And therefore, we cut right to the chase. Are you willing to change this midah, this part of your culture, this part of your civilization? And if the answer is no, forget it. It's not going to work. Because the whole Torah is about being ready to change. We accepted the Torah. So we means we can we accept the possibility that we can change and our need sometimes to change so to be mevatar ourselves to the Ratzon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like it says in Pirkei Avos. And therefore, again, that's what Rabbi Tversky represented. Belief that everybody can change, everybody can improve, everybody can become better. That's really, I think, what his life and his life's mission and his work, putting together all these things, the psychiatry and the chassidus and the learning and the devotion to mitzvahs and the diktuk ha-mitzvahs and so on, everything which he represented was because you can always change for the better. I can help other people change and I can inspire other people to change. That, I think, is what he was all about. As is well known now, the famous Niggun, that everybody knows, it was written by Rabbi Tversky. I happened to have found that out a bunch of years ago when one time he didn't go to Eretz Yisrael, lived in Tinek, when he didn't go to Eretz Yisrael, that the Yontif, he was by us for Simchas Torah, and I started that niggun when we gave him the Hakofa. I started that niggun, and it was very, very, I told people he wrote the niggun, it was very, very spirited dancing. The truth is, when I learned from my uncle, Kriptacha, years ago that he wrote that niggun, I was stunned because I thought that that niggun was one of the things which Chazal say was created that first Erev Shabbos Ben Hashmashos. You know, there's certain things. I thought it was as old as the hills. But it turns out that he wrote it in 1960. And every shul in the world sings that in Simchas Torah. And Ratursky once said to me, and I know he said it to others also, he believes, and that's what those who saw at the Levaya, he didn't want any hespedim, but he said they should sing that niggun because he felt that that niggun was his ticket to Olam Haba. I'm pretty confident he had many tickets to Olam Haba. That may have been one of them, but many other tickets to Olam Haba as well. Yehi Zichro Baruch. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Talbis. And now if Dr. Palkovitz could share some words with us. You're muted, Dr. Palkovitz.
Okay, sorry. Can you hear me okay now? Yeah. Okay, sorry. I was saying that I could listen to Rabbi Talbis all night, so I certainly can't match that in any way. But there's a lot of overlap, but I'll try to build on the brilliant words of Rabbi Talbis. Let me start with some of the thoughts that that have been shared in some of the svarim that Rabbi Talbis was talking about, in terms of what the Stipler told Rabbi Tversky on how to enhance the chances of a spiritual success in medical school, because as you look at it, I was just thinking about how basic it is, but how it's something that we could bring with us in terms of bringing the clarity that we need in terms of being able to withstand the workplace once we leave the Dalet Amos of Yeshiva. So he said, you know, he told him, that he was initially quite negative about him going to medical school, but then he realized that this is a mind that and a soul that could change the world if he had the ability that would come with being a physician. And he said, you know, you need the following five categories. One is to be kaveitim, to learn in depth at least 2 hours a day, which could not have been easy given the grueling kinds of schedule of medical school, to recite old tefillos with the minyan. I'm not quite sure how easy that might have been, and to go to mikvah on a regular basis, and then to be extremely careful with Shemira Shabbos and a daily Musar Seder. And I was thinking about not so much about those very clear recommendations, but about the fact that Rabbi Dr. Tversky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, he really, I don't think he was going to go ahead with his dream about becoming a physician unless he got a true okay from his Rebbe, from the Stipler. And that's something that I think is increasingly rare. And I want to share a few thoughts. My connection to Rabbi Dr. Tversky was one that was extremely kind of common. Nothing like what we've been hearing from Rabbi Taubes. It was common in the sense that among the tens of thousands of others, I carried him in my head. You know, sometimes you don't know that you carry somebody in your head, but literally the day after his patira, as I was giving different lectures and different talks to different audiences in different part of the world, I kept finding myself quoting Rabbi Dr. Tversky, Rav Shia Tversky. And then I was thinking, like, wow, I didn't even realize that I carried his voice inside of me, inside of my head and inside of my heart. I had absolutely no idea. And I don't think it's just that I was primed to be seeing it. It was literally something that was coming out of me, because it turns out that without even realizing it, I had absorbed some basic thoughts about parenting, some basic thoughts about child psychology, some basic thoughts about some of the most fundamental yesodos of being able to have influence on people. And it was amazing to see. I was just surprised. It was totally unconscious how we could absorb somebody. Let me share with you a few specific categories. Number one is the power of clarity. What we've just been hearing so beautifully was that this is a man who had incredible clarity about where he was going, what his goals are, and what he was going to do with what he had. Now, I was thinking that I like reviewing some of the books and some of the articles written by Dr. Olener. Dr. Olener is somebody who, when he was 10 years old, virtually everybody he ever knew was murdered by the Nazis. And he managed in the chaos to escape to a home, a farm on the outskirts of his town. And the people who lived there immediately took him in, realizing this must be a Jewish child who escaped the massacre at the other side of town. And they immediately knew how to basically treat him like one of their own, even though had they been discovered, everybody they knew would have been tortured and killed, including their own children, their neighbors. And he didn't hesitate. The parents in that home didn't hesitate for even a minute. And then Dr. Olener spent his life together with his wife, who also got a PhD in sociology, just going and visiting every single righteous Gentile to ask, what was the key to your unbelievable moral heroism? And what came out over and over again was, how could we not? It wasn't a false modesty. It was just like, it was so clear to them what the right thing was to do. And it was, there was so much light shined in their heart and in their minds about how do you handle these kind of unbelievable moral challenges, that they immediately did something. And virtually everybody that the Oleners interviewed throughout Europe had the same question. I don't understand your question, when they were asked, how could you have done what you did? That's kind of the pattern that I've seen throughout Rabbi Dr. Twersky's life. He was a man who just had a combination of moral courage and a sort of a clear thinking about, here's the right thing to do. Here's what I've absorbed into my heart and into my soul, and here's how I'm gonna act. And you know, I was thinking about one of the examples of the kind of courage that he wouldn't even consider to be courage. He wrote a book, a very well-known book, called The Shame Born of Silence, which was about domestic violence in our community. And he met with tremendous opposition in terms of all kinds of threats on him, on his house, on the other svarim that he had. By the way, the number of the svarim, which I heard from him, but heard from other sources, is he ended up writing 90 svarim, 90, which is beyond belief. It's beyond belief. That's the final number. Because I used to introduce him when I was on the same program as him, as having written 60, because that's the number that was, I think, on the Wikipedia page. And sometimes he would just sort of gently correct me, not out of gaiva, God forbid, but out of opposite. It's just, you know, this is the truth. This is the number. And the final number that was talked about at the various Hespedim, and what I heard from various sources, was 90, which is just kind of beyond belief. And he talked about it. He said that, you know, this is his addiction. His addiction is to writing. And that's why he had such a difficult time when he found that it wasn't so easy for him. And when he wrote, my will has run dry. But it was so fascinating about that that piece, which his wife, Dr. Gail Bessler, an amazing, amazing woman and very respected therapist, she basically wrote an answer to My Well Is Run Dry. But to me, My Well Is Run Dry was a perfect example of Rabbi Dr. Twersky's honesty about his imperfection. He had a recurring theme in his writing and in his thinking about how we need to handle the failures and challenges in our life, including our imperfection. You know, there's a classic book that's used in the substance abuse community called The Spirituality of Imperfection. And very often, that's what he would write about, which is that there's no reason to have shame about our shortcomings. In fact, we need to see it as just a sign that we're alive and that we all have something to offer. Similar to what we were just hearing from Rabbi Taubes, I was often amazed that here is one of the most brilliant men of our time, certainly one of the most brilliant Talmidei Chachamim, combined with mental health experts and substance abuse experts. And whenever I would speak at a Nefesh conference or at some other event, he and Dr. Gail Bessler, his wife, would come up front, and he would adjust his whatever hearing devices he had, and he would listen together with Gail in a way that was, it just felt terrific. Because what do I possibly have to say that he doesn't know a million times more about? But that was his way. His way was to respect everybody equally, to learn from everybody, and to go through life with that kind of enactment of true, true anivus. You know, there's the thought about the luchos, you know, about the tablets that were set up at the entrance to Eretz Yisrael. And there was very, very clearly, you know, what we're told about those is that it was to remind us about what's the core? What's the core of what we need to believe in and what our goals are and what we have to have front and center in our minds? And I'm reminded of a study that I might have shared with some of you. It's a study about insurance forms. They found that the insurance industry was losing tens of billions of dollars in fraudulent claims when there was a burglary in a home or any kind of a home insurance claims. So they did a simple thing. They took a box that they put on the bottom of a form that said, on the penalty of perjury, everything I said above is 100% true, and I'm not lying at all. And psychologists who were hired by the insurance industry just took that box and put it at the top of the form. And when they put it at the top of the form, that before you even answered any question, you were told it's very important to tell the truth here. Here's why you have to tell the truth. Here's the danger of not telling the truth. But also, it costs all of us a tremendous amount of money if you lie. Just by that simple act of putting that front and center, and the industry saved billions and billions of dollars. And that's the kind of role model that Rabbi Twersky has been for our generation and for anybody who knew him. You know, he had a self-concept, and we know that all 90 books, as he often said, were about different variations on the theme of self-concept, of Kavod Atzmi. And I was thinking after his Patira that the Bali Musar say that why is it that we're told that your makom, if you have a makom kavua in shul, you're a ben olam haba. You're gonna have a portion in the world to come. Doesn't make much sense. What's so unbelievably important about having a makom kavua in shul? And the answer the Bali Musar say is because if you have a makom kavua in shul, it means you're not taking anybody else's place. You have to know who you are. Rabbi Dr. Twersky knew who he was. And he had the unbelievable confidence in himself without a shred of self-importance. His ability to model for us through humor. His ability to have the kind of relationship that we heard before with the Charles Schultz, so that when you go to my waiting room here, you'll see that I have the whole collection of Rabbi Dr. Twersky's Peanuts books, because there's so much wisdom there in terms of what he learned from his connection with Rabbi Schultz, with Charles Schultz, who literally wanted to spend the last day of his life, the last moments of his life, with Rabbi Dr. Twersky sitting at his side. Rabbi Twersky said it was an extremely painful experience for him, but to see his good friend in so much pain. But it says worlds about a man who was such an unbelievable Adam Gadol to have that kind of humility to connect to, you know, basically somebody like Charles Schulz. And I'll tell you something, of the books I've had to replace the most, every single person who comes to see me, literally without without exception, when I come to get them from my waiting room, they don't want to put their book down. They often borrow it, and I have to keep on buying them again, because everybody is just so taken with the way you know, Rav Shiya Twersky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, applied the words of Schulz in a way that brings wisdom and insight, that brings light to the darkness. And then the final story before I get to my closing thoughts is the ability to have a philosophy of parenting that finds a perfect balance between love and limits. You know, with a very gentle hand. Many of us have heard the story, but it's my favorite story. It's one of the stories that's been echoing through my mind since his patira. And it's the story of the Rosh Hashanah in Milwaukee, when Rabbi Dr. Twersky was very, very young. I think he was 5 or 6 years old. I mean, he was very young. And he was a chess prodigy. He was a brilliant chess player, which shouldn't surprise us. He was brilliant in pretty much everything he did. And although, you know, you never felt that he carried it with any kind of arrogance or any kind of gaiva. And there was a more modern kind of rabbi who was stuck in Milwaukee for the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, either because of a storm. I forget why he was stuck, but he was stuck. And he, after davening, the future, you know, actually, you know, Rav Shiya Twersky, the future Rabbi Dr. Twersky, played a bunch of chess games with this rabbi, all, you know, pretty much all Yontif afternoon. And his father came to him and said, Sashi, I saw that you were playing chess on Rosh Hashanah afternoon with, you know, with this rabbi. And Rabbi Twersky said, yeah, but he told me, he's a rabbi, he told me I could play with him. And he said his father didn't raise his voice. He didn't really say much of anything. He just gently shook his head no. Gently shook his head no. This doesn't pass. You know, you're better than this. And Rabbi Twersky said it cut through him like a knife. He was destroyed by that. All with a simple shaking of the head no. But then his father, in keeping with the Twersky brilliance, goes over to his son and says, "Nu, and who won?" And Rashia said, "I won all the games. I won all the games." And it's that combination of the kavod atzmi, of the confidence, combined with the perfect balance between love and limits. I'm going to end, because I know we're coming to the end of our time. First of all, with some recommendations for you know, all the people who are listening here. Here's an example from a Time magazine article, beautiful article written on this by Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman of Einstein, and my nephew Menachem Butler, who wrote a terrific article with all kinds of amazing sources on this. And here's what the Times magazine said on June 15th of 1959. Lectures on Saturday, religious holidays sometimes required months of advanced planning. The 9-day holiday of Sukkot, for instance, with 4 days when work is forbidden, Time magazine said, fell during a series of lectures before a make or break exam in pathology. Abe, his students and professor call him, met the situation by studying by himself all the preceding summer, put himself so far ahead of his class that he could afford to miss the lectures. I hated like heck to miss them, he explains, but I creamed that exam. I mean, how's that for planning ahead, for being so unbelievably planful? So it's true that he accomplished an incredible amount, but it was with the kind of discipline that we could all be inspired by. And I'm going to just end with a couple of thoughts from the brilliant hesped given by Rav Michal Twersky, one of Rav Shia's many brilliant brothers. And here's what he said, which I just learned so much from. And with this, I'll end. He said, my brother was not inhibited by the need to be perfect. He understood the need for us to do our best, to be conscientious, to try for excellence. But he understood that perfection can be a destructive force. What a gift that is, to be able to interact with people with being given the message that it's fine to mess up. It's part of being alive. It's fine, you know, just keep on going, fail better, to quote something that my father, Olav Shalom, often talked about. We have to learn as we get older how to fail better, how to fail well, and to understand that perfection misapplied could be a destructive force. And then there's the other part, be aware of our talents and strength. Develop our signature strengths without perfection. To be a Baal Chesed as much as you can is the key to happiness. And I have a bunch of stories with this, but I'll censor myself. And to learn from everybody, to learn from everybody. I keep picturing him sitting up front for people's talks who, didn't hold a candle to him, talking about myself, not talking chas v'shalom about Rabbi Taubes, who is in a very different category. Be optimistic, to learn how to look for the good. And then Rav Michal Twersky said, we always have to remember our children are a seed that want to be valued, respected, and honored. And our job as parents or for ourselves is to nourish that seed. And I'll just end with the beautiful thoughts, just because it was running through my head and it's hanging on my wall. So I'll just read it. The beautiful thoughts of Rev Cook, which is all about bringing light to the world, to a world filled with all too much darkness. Sarach shekol ish yeda v'yavin shebetoch tocho dolek ner. Everybody has to understand that in his inner essence, there is a flame. The ain ish ain lo ner, there isn't a person alive who doesn't have a flame. Bitsarah shekol ish yeda v'yavin, sha'olav lamol ulegalos es or haner barabim. Everybody has to understand that it's our job to share our uniqueness with others. Ulahadliko lavuka gedola lahair ha'olam kulam, to set the world ablaze with the bonfire of each of our unique flames. That's what Rabbi Dr. Shia Twersky, Zecher Tzadik Levracha's life was all about. And I hope to continue, and I hope we all could be continued to be inspired by a person who so many of us were privileged to be touched by. I will always hold that Twersky section of my library sacred, and I'll just have to keep buying more and more peanut books. Thank you, everybody.